You're listening to SBS On The Money with Ricardo Gonçalves.
Hi everyone, it is Wednesday the 30th of April 2025 on a day where the Australian share market rose by 0.7% to a fresh two-month high. We'll have the details with Francesco Destratis from Ord Minnett in a few moments. But first to inflation, and an interest rate cut in May looks increasingly likely. That's as the underlying rate of inflation, which is the preferred measure by the Reserve Bank, fell into the bank's target band of 2 to 3%. For the first time since December 2021. For more on that and the inflationary outlook, I spoke with Michaela Fucilla, the chief economist at Jarden Group. So Michaela, first of all, how would you describe the inflationary environment at the moment?
Well, I think we could celebrate some progress towards the target, particularly at the underlying level of inflation. We're seeing inflationary pressures finally easing in components that we hadn't seen before, for instance, housing is one of those, insurances is another one, rents is another one. So I think we could take a step back and beyond all the uncertainty that we are seeing, the inflation environment is definitely much better than it was a year ago.
You mentioned those three components there, which are all part of the services inflation basket, right? It's been so sticky for so long. These services often reflect parts of a consumer's wallet, I guess, that really impacts the cost of living, rents, insurance, even education. Even though services inflation is now at its slowest annual pace since June 2022, which is something to be celebrated, they're still taking a big chunk out of the consumer wallet though, isn't it?
That's correct. And even though it's slowing, we actually saw essential services pick up in this quarter. So that's something to take into account because it's not about the pace of growth in those, it's about how elevated they have been. And as you said, they do take a long part of the consumer wallet. The outlook, though, is mixed across all of those. I will be watching, for instance, how insurance prices adjust in quarter two, because we have not only the health premiums going up, we also had very bad weather, a cyclone in Queensland, some floods. That will probably boost premiums for houses and also autos. So there's a lot of things going on there. And those essential services such as health, for instance, they have a high reliance on employment. So they're very high dependent on nurses and doctors, and those prices of wages and labor cost in general, they remain sticky and they're still going up. So I guess we can take the win on the underlying side, but if you look too close, there's stuff that needs to still come down to a more comfortable level to support the consumer.
I guess areas where we're starting to see some deflation, we know that petrol's down about 5% year on year. Electricity's down around 11.5% year on year, although we're starting to see some pressures rising there because of some government rebates rolling off, right? So yeah. Given that these numbers come ahead of the federal election at the weekend, can you tell us a bit more about how government policy has impacted consumer prices?
Yeah, I guess from an economist perspective, it's been particularly hard to forecast how these subsidies coming in and out of the data will flow. And from an RBA perspective as well, right? Like, it's very difficult to have a good read of the inflation momentum when you look at how much policy support it has been. We have the election coming over the weekend, but I think we can all agree that regardless of the outcome, support from the fiscal side of things will still be elevated. There's rental support. There's electricity rebates. There's also childcare coming through if the Labor gets re-elected. So there's a lot more going on. All of these initially help to optically lower the headline inflation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that underlying inflations will stay contained. Eventually, when those roll back, we will see headline returning and perhaps not good news for consumers on that front.
You mentioned earlier that it's hard to forecast inflation with government subsidies, one thing, but is there anything in these numbers that can show us what these the implication of global tariff policy will mean to consumer prices?
Not yet. We did see, though, a small increase in shipping costs ahead of the tariffs. That was particularly the case for China, but that was very early over the summer. That was evident in a small rise of goods prices in this quarter. So we will watch going forward how the tariffs impact. We don't expect much, but there is a 10% that Australia will have to see, and that's from April, unless there's some decision or anything changes, which is seems unlikely. So we will see some of those goods and perhaps those more currency exposed sectors showing a little bit more impact, considering that the currency has weakened on the back of this news, and see how that flows through the data as well. All of those have been the one that have been very, very steady and low. So that perhaps is an upside risk from quarter two onwards.
And finally, now that headline inflation, along with underlying inflation, both are now within the RBA's 2 to 3% target band, what does this mean for the RBA in terms of, does it cement a May interest rate cut? How many more after that? And how will the federal election also impact it?
Yeah, so there's a few things in terms of the RBA cut in May. I think it's pretty much a done deal at this point. The RBA had already had in place an easing bias. They've already eased in February, saying they're content with the progress on inflation. This data is overall very consistent with their forecast that were put in place in February. So all of that suggests that regardless of the global shock, there is a strong case for them to ease. Even the labor market's looking not as tight on very recent data and leading indicators. So I would say May, it's consistent with their guidance to ease in May. That doesn't mean the RBA will panic. We expect them to just gradually bring rates down two more times this year, August and November. But of course, as I said, we're forecasting in the absence of a major shock and dislocations in the market. The currency being so weak also offsets some of this weakness and the tariffs impact. So that's another thing the RBA can sit in and actually watch the underlying drivers of growth and inflation to decide on rates. In terms of the election, I guess normally in an election cycle, we'll see weakness in the sentiment measures. So housing, for instance, auction clearance rates tend to be weaker. We also see consumer confidence and also business confidence showing some uncertainty around the outcomes. In this cycle, it's very hard to tell what is driving that uncertainty and that softer sentiment across businesses and consumers because there's too many shocks going on. So I guess once the election uncertainty is out of the way, then the RBA can have a better idea of what the consumer and the businesses are feeling.
It's Michaela Fucilla there, the chief economist at Jarden Group. We'll take a look at the market impact in a few moments. But first, we're going to segue to work from home, because as the debate continues about how work from home impacts productivity and the economy, new research from the Committee for Economic Development has found those that do are saving an estimated $5,300 a year, thanks mainly to less travel time. That makes up for the lower pay many are taking home for the privilege. For more on that and the implications for businesses and for people themselves, Veronica Lennett spoke with James Brook, an economist at CEDA.
So our research has shown that people, firstly, who previously faced barriers into on-site employment have opted into more working from home roles. We then also showed that the actual value of working from home is highly valued by employees at around about $4,400 a year for the average employee. And this latest research is really showing where these benefits for the employee come from. So we looked at commuting and hours worked, and we found that the average work from home employee is saving about 15.7% less time commuting than they otherwise would. They're also able to work about 10% more hours a week because they can work from home and they've saved that time.
So were there any groups in particular that got particular benefits from working from home?
Yeah, so we first showed that groups such as mothers with young children, people who have health conditions and disabilities, and people who are primary carers had increased their participation into working from home roles. And in our latest research, we show that pre-COVID to now, the likelihood that they're in a job at all has actually increased. So this is a function of a tight labour market and demand for workers, but it's hard to ignore that working from home has given more people opportunities, so they're able to find more jobs which are suited to them.
We know that there are many people who are taking perhaps pay cuts to be able to work from home. How does this kind of balance out with the decreases in other kind of costs they might be facing?
So our previous research showed that workers were forgoing about $4,400 a year to continue to work from home. Here we valued just the time saving people get from avoided commuting, and we valued this at about $5,300 a year based on the average wage of someone who works from home. So it's clear to see that with that time saved and the additional hours they can do, this still comes at higher of what our previous result about what they were forgoing is.
What about from the other kind of perspective? What kind of benefits and challenges might there be for employers, or like a social cost to having more staff work from home?
Yeah, so employers are in a pretty interesting position. So on the one hand, they benefit from employees being able to work more hours and a deeper pool of labor to hire from, but they're also having to manage all these new ways of working and keep up the things they know are important to firms, like innovation and culture and collaboration. And they're sort of working this out as they go. So it's important to note, while we've found there's a lot of benefits to bosses and to workers as well, there is a lot of unknowns of how you manage the culture of an organization with this new way of working. And that's what they're really facing at the moment.
How can companies monitor the success of working from home within their organizations? Do they need to also add like monitoring for their employees? And how do they kind of balance the need to protect confidential information with these kind of benefits for employees?
This is something that all companies are sort of working through at the moment, right? But it's really probably up to managers and their teams as to what's going to work best for them. Because what works with hybrid and fully in-office work is wildly different depending on what type of tasks workers have. So, for instance, people in largely administrative roles, the evidence is pretty clear that they're very productive from home. But for roles where collaboration and culture and innovation and that teamwork is really important, it's not sure exactly sure how companies should balance this out. So what we would really advise is that managers and workers are sort of enabled to work through that. And I think to your question, data collection is really important for evaluating what is working, but of course it shouldn't infringe upon people's rights to privacy and things like that.
What are the kinds of impacts on productivity and the broader economy? Is there a tangible connection between working from home and any kind of productivity gain or loss?
Yeah, so this is kind of the big question we're all trying to work out. What we know through international evidence is that hybrid workers are at least as productive as their in-office colleagues, and there's also some retention benefits there. So they're less likely to quit than their in-office colleagues. So on the one hand, we don't really see any difference in productivity, but we also see all these benefits in terms of extra hours worked and the size of the labor pool that firms are able to hire from. What remains a bit unknown is how those impacts like learning and collaboration are going to play out in this new hybrid environment. And more research needs to be done in this area.
Books there from Cedar.
Now, Market Day on the SBS On The Money podcast.
That was another good day on the Australian share market. The S&P ASX 200 up 0.7%, well above 8,000, 8,126. I think it's about 5 days of gains now. And the market is up 10.7% since the low point earlier this month, straight after Donald Trump's so-called reciprocal tariffs. So for more on that and the future direction for the share market, I spoke with Francesco De Stratis, an investment advisor at Ord Minnett. Francesco, the market is up again today. What's driving it?
Yeah, good afternoon, Ricardo. Look, the market had a positive lead from the US, particularly now that I suppose the markets are starting to understand that the Trump government and other countries are going to start negotiating on tariffs. So I think there's a bit of easing of the pressure on the tariff side of things. The quarterly inflation numbers came out. They were quite good, coming back into line with RBA preferred range. Energy stocks were a bit lower. That was a softening of the oil price. I think there's a little bit more supply coming on stream at the moment. But on the positive side, there's a bit of a mixed bag. The property trusts or REITs are positive in expectations of maybe some rate cuts down the track. Banks and financials are somewhat positive again, similarly from that expectation of rate cuts. And we're seeing some bigger stocks in the healthcare have a bit of a turnaround, along with the discretionary retailers.
Let's break up some of what you were talking about. So the market's doing pretty well. The 200 now back above 8,000 points at levels pre-Trump's Liberation Day. Is the worst over? And to what extent has investor sentiment actually changed?
Yeah, look, Blinken, you missed it. You know, the market's bounced back a lot quicker than I would have expected as well, particularly where, you know, when a lot of this talk about the tariffs started and back when we were in our highs, the markets were, particularly the Australian market was overvalued, the US market was overvalued. We come back into some sort of closer to fair value. I thought we were still a little bit overvalued, but I think what the market is seeing is some positive momentum on more the talk around the tariffs about negotiating a better outcome. And if the US consumer, you know, stays on track, I think that's a positive for most of the global economy. Obviously, China's going to be impacted significantly, but other countries might see some positives come out of that. There's a bit of confidence coming out of these trade tensions. And we're starting to see some strong corporate earnings. That's historical. Markets are starting to look ahead as well. The change in sentiment, look, global markets are starting to improve. Optimism on interest rate expectations is a real positive for the markets. You know, certain sectors, I suppose, are starting to show some signs of good value there. I think you've got to be a bit selective in that, though.
You mentioned the US consumer there, right? What's the outlook for US stocks? Because we've got reporting season really ramping up over the next week.
Yeah, look, it is starting to ramp up. And I think consensus analysts have got earnings growth of about 7.2% in the S&P 500. That's positive. We're starting to see some early signs of that. The corporate earnings are starting to come through, early signs on the banking sector. So some of the giants like JP Morgan Chase, and Wells Fargo have put out some positive results. Big tech, we're looking to next week, and there's expectations of some positives coming out of there. On the flip side, though, there are some challenges still. Whilst we, I've been just saying the positives on the world trade tensions, I think we're starting to see that ease a bit. That's providing some positive in the markets. And on the other side of it is, you know, we're seeing a little bit of a sign of slowing GDP in the US. So that might have a little bit of a negative impact upon their market as well.
I spoke to Michaela Ficilla from Jarden Group in detail about the inflation numbers, but what's the market saying about those inflation numbers and the implication for interest rates?
Well, the market likes it. Obviously, the headline rates between the target range for the Reserve Bank at 2 to 3%, but more importantly, the trim and mean. So that strips out a lot of noise for the Reserve Bank, is down to 2.9%, which is, again, between that 2 to 3%. That's the first time in 3 years that we've been there. That's a positive sign from the markets. We're probably expecting to see a rate cut in their next meeting in May, so post-election, obviously. They don't want to be seen to be imposing upon the election. And that provides positive signs for the equities markets, particularly in some sectors that are reliant upon borrowing, like REITs and infrastructure stocks in particular. So if we start to see that rate cut come through in May, I think their meeting's on the 20th, we could see some more towards the end of the year, which will provide some positive signs for the ASX.
And finally, we know the market's still volatile, even though we're seeing some consistent gains over the past few sessions. What are you telling your clients at the moment, and are there still any opportunities for investors?
Yeah, looking at it from a sectoral approach, as I mentioned just before, interest rates coming off will put the property trusts or REITs back in the spotlight. Obviously, they work on a fair bit of gearing. If you can bring down that those interest costs on property trusts and on companies like infrastructure stocks like APA and Transurban, obviously that puts a bit more into their bottom line. So some positive signs for those types of companies. Obviously, discretionary retailers will benefit because if people's mortgages are a bit lower, they get a little bit more money to spend in the shops. So therefore, they might see some positive signs in the discretionary area. Healthcare stocks have been under the pump in recent months. I think they're undervalued. We're seeing companies like ResMed and CSL trading below their long-term price multiples. So I think there's some opportunities there. Being selective over the last 6 months, rather than look at the broader market and broader sectors, identifying stocks that have been punished for bad news. One I will mention is Mineral Resources. I think we've seen the worst of it. You know, there's a fair bit of short covering to come out of that. And now we're starting to see that the problems they've had have been outlined, and I think the market can assess where they go from here. So Mineral Resources is probably another one that I'll be looking at.
It's Francesco De Stratis from Ord Minnett. Don't forget, if you enjoy the podcast, give it a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and to click that subscribe button.
This SBS On The Money stream is provided for informational purposes only. The content in this stream should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and it does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision. This SBS On The Money podcast is provided for informational purposes only. The content on this podcast should not be understood as constituting advice or a recommendation. It is not personal advice and does not consider your personal circumstances or objectives. You should contact a licensed professional before making any financial decision.